Howdy and welcome to Thin Air, news with an altitude from small town public radio in the Rockies and Four Corners. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Gina Gracio. Howdy. This month, some Colorado ski resorts learn how to talk to their foreign workers.
I've spoken loud. I have used some of my Spanish that I learned in Mexico.
A report from Aspen: can the 10th Mountain Division save Mount Everest from resort hotel development?
They don't even have a word for insulation or cozy.
We take you to a punk rock concert in, you heard it right, Montrose.
Say what you want to say, wear what you want to wear, act how you want to act.
And we talk to a Santa Fe composer who writes music for Shakespeare productions.
Well, I have started stealing from myself, actually.
We start with our monthly mosey around the Thin Air beat.
Last year, the New Mexico Supreme Court struck down a teen curfew law that compelled those under the age of 17 to stay off the streets between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. Now the legislature is considering an amendment to the New Mexico Children's Code that would allow the curfew to be reinstated. The curfew is being supported by police but opposed by the American Civil Liberties Union on the grounds that it violates the due process rights of children.
Also last month in Santa Fe, the opening of the Family Advocacy Center for Victims of Sexual Abuse. The center is operated by Santa Fe's police, the Rape Crisis Center, and St. Vincent's Hospital.
The U.S. Forest Service has approved a controversial land swap that puts 120 acres of federal land in private hands at the base of the Grand Targhee Ski Resort. The land was appraised at $28,000 per acre, while nearby lots in Alta, Wyoming were going for $55,000 an acre. The Greater Yellowstone Coalition says the decision tosses fuel on the flames of growth in the area. In the land swap, the Forest Service acquires a 400-acre parcel called Squirrel Meadows, which contains wetlands and grizz habitat, but leaves a 20-acre inholding. The Jackson Hole Conservation Alliance promises to appeal.
Here's a report from Marilyn Gleason at KDNK Carbondale.
It'll take more than a blue light special to get Carbondale shoppers excited about the Crystal River Market. Plans for the 400,000-square-foot shopping mall brought about 150 residents to a meeting of the town trustees last month to show their opposition. But zoning laws could backfire on growth opponents. The 22-acre site of the proposed mall at the corner of Carbondale's Main Street and State Highway 133 is zoned for large commercial development. The design by OTAC Rock Creek Studios, a local architecture firm known for its new urbanist approach, includes a so-called village component with residential units over the commercial space, along with a more conventional mall. Carbondale's height limit of 35 feet would also be exceeded by some of the roof lines in the village area under the current design. Architect Dave Michelson says he talked developers into the residential units and other variations to enhance what might otherwise have been a generic big box mall. At the December meeting, more than 30 Carbondale residents stood to voice their opposition to the Crystal River Market. One after another pleaded for a development that would reflect the unique spirit of Carbondale. Several of the suggestions themselves reflected that spirit. Residents asked developers to equip the mall with solar power, employ green building techniques, rent spaces to cottage industries, and even build in stages as the need for retail grows. But in an ironic twist, Michelson warned that mounting opposition could convince developers to take the path of least resistance by dropping the residential units and high roof lines.
Can Vail become a mini Silicon Valley? It was looking promising with 24 internet-related businesses in the area, including Agency.com with its brand new 20,000-square-foot complex in Avon. But the 84 designers and programmers at Agency.com have been handed their pink slips and 3-month severance pay to ski away the rest of the winter.
The Vail office began as a local company, Eagle River Interactive, back in 1994. Analysts say the new owner, New York-based Agency.com, is running out of cash. Up in Steamboat Springs, the 12 families living at Trailer Haven are being evicted to make way for tennis courts. The local health and recreation board, citing no moral obligation, will nonetheless pay each tenant $4,000 to move out.
But the big news in Steamboat is the merger of its ski resort owner, American Skiing, with Doral Hotels. American Skiing had $450 million in high-interest debt after building its nine-resort empire. Now the Steamboat ski area will be under the Doral Leisure Division, which is big on creating and selling fractional ownerships.
Crested Butte is the latest Colorado ski resort to feel the impact from an influx of foreign workers who, nevertheless, are getting a warm welcome in the Gunnison Valley. Tony Todd reports from KBUT.
For over a century, immigrants have made their way to the Gunnison Valley in search of good jobs and a better life. In the past, they came from Europe. Today, most are Cora Indians from central Mexico. Recently, county commissioners invited human services and healthcare workers, employers, clergy, and interested citizens to discuss the recent influx into our community.
For the past 3 to 4 years, there has been a growing discussion regarding the increasing numbers of non-English speaking residents in Gunnison County.
John DeVore is Gunnison County Manager. He said that because of the tight labor market nationwide, local employers are having great difficulty in filling open positions. As of just last week, there were 132 listings for more than 200 jobs at the local job service, and the employment sections of local newspapers seem to get larger every week.
The path Board of County Commissioners chose was began to engage the community by first discussing the evolution of our workforce, identify some of the issues this has created, and third and most importantly, began to develop strategies for the future.
While some of the newcomers are in this country legally, many are not. In some families, only the children are U.S. citizens. Sue Steinbeck works for Gunnison Social Services. She says that federal welfare reforms have limited the amount of support her agency can provide to families in need.
A whole family household might be surviving on the benefits given for three that are stretched to five.
Steinbeck emphasized that the Cora are not looking for handouts and are grateful for any job opportunity that comes their way.
I was speaking with an employer recently. This happens to be someone who owns a motel. She said to me, "These Cora Indians are the finest workers I've ever encountered. They never fail to call in if they can't be there or let us know. They're eager to go to work. They're delighted to be working only 8 hours a day. Even at minimum wage, they are rich on the 41-20, where in their own country they could labor for 10 to 12 hours to get $5. It means that they have a better quality of life, and I find they have the same needs all of us do. The needs for decent housing, the needs for adequate safe child care, the needs for nutritious food, the need for safety, the need to be accepted, the need to be a part of a community."
School Superintendent Mike Richardson said that this year there are 48 students enrolled for whom English is a second language. That's up from 22 last year. He said the kids have shown great adaptability, fitting in and making friends fast. But if the number continues to increase, the district will most likely need to hire additional bilingual personnel.
What we care about most is dealing with them effectively, and that means dealing with the whole child, the family, their environment, before they come to school, when they're in school.
The greatest difficulty expressed by those who interact with the immigrants is language. Though many of the new residents speak and understand Spanish, the majority are most comfortable with their own Cora dialect.
Our resources are limited linguistically. I know, as I have visited in some of the homes of specifically the Cora people, I've spoken loud. I have used some of my Spanish that I learned in New Mexico, worky, trucky, add the E on the end. But amazingly, we've gotten along pretty good.
Jerry Hodges is a Baptist minister and member of the Gunnison Valley Ministerial Alliance.
Some of the observations that we have made thus far, we are dealing with human beings. They're, as Ann said, they're people just like us, and we just have some barriers, the main one being language, second one being culture.
DeVore emphasized the need for Gunnison County to get all funding and services to which it is entitled in order to help the newcomers assimilate.
difficulty we have, a lot of state and federal resources come to us based on old numbers, based on population statistics that are 10 years old, based on population makeups that are 10 years old, don't really recognize special needs populations. We end up with some agencies who have put up their shop in Delta Montrose and claim to provide services to a six-county area, and some of them we've never seen.
This year, a number of Mexican nationals fill seasonal positions at Crested Butte Mountain Resort.
The majority came because of work, and four came because they had relatives here. We asked them if they felt welcome here, and they all responded with a resounding yes. I think the families do feel welcome here. They feel like we're doing the best that we can to serve them and make them feel as if they're part of our community.
A number of people signed on to join a committee which will research and brainstorm ways of helping the immigrants to succeed here in their new home. For KBUT, I'm Tony Todd.
Rick DeSelm is on a quest for knowledge and a deeper understanding of different cultures. Starting from Moab, Utah, DeSelm plans to hitchhike to Colombia, sharing his culture through music and poetry.
Part of it is a personal quest for new directions in my own life. It's just that time of life.
He calls himself a traveling correspondent, and he hopes the idea catches on. From humble beginnings, DeSelm started by reaching out to the Latino community in Telluride by hosting parties at his small affordable housing unit that he called Cabaret on the Edge, inviting the invisible Latin community to share stories and music with him and any other gringos brave enough to attend.
Starting from the parties, just holding the parties and being surprised at how that was a natural outreach to the Spanish-speaking community.
DeSelm passes on a message of living now and sharing the beauty of nature.
What's going on? Is it a work day? Keeping busy, making a living, so we can retire at 65, already dead inside, keep our bodies ticking till they're 99, and die with tubes in our noses? It's not how long you live, my friend. It's not how many nights in a row you get an 8 hours sleep. It's not how many decades you can go and never miss a meal. You want good food? Go hungry. Forget you're alive. Climb a mountain. Take some can of beans along. You want career, success, long life, a pleasant time? Forget it. I'll give you life. Go kiss sweet nature's ass, good buddy. Lie in thickets. Shiver. Sweat. Stand on cliffs. Feel the wind. Ride the high ravine on weary legs with screaming laughter. Call the coyotes up from wooded hideouts in the moonlight. And when they answer, ask them. In a howl, are you alive?
How do we keep Hilton or Ramada Inn from building on the flanks of Mount Everest? Some determined Aspen residents think the answer lies in providing an alternative, Marilyn Gleason reports from KDNK.
Now, halfway across the world, on the Mount Everest Massif in Chinese Tibet, the 10th Mountain Association is lending its expertise to create a hut system for trekkers. The number of visitors to the world's highest mountain has exploded in the last 15 years, from virtually none to about 20,000 a year. Development plans for Everest project over 3 million tourists in the next 30 years. A nonprofit organization called Future Generations is deeply involved in the Chomolungma National Nature Preserve, created by the Chinese in 1989. Daniel Taylor-Ide founded Future Generations.
For the last 15 years, we've been involved in supporting a very innovative conservation project in Tibet on the north slope of Mount Everest. The park is the size of the state of Massachusetts, 6 million acres. There are 80,000 people who live inside the park. And what's distinctive is that the people themselves are doing the conservation management. There are no wardens. And in return for that, the people have to get some improvements in their lives. And this is where the idea of the hut system comes in. 10th Mountain Division became involved because we were so impressed by the way they ran their huts. And they offered to, out of generosity, help train the people, provide an internship. And they sent over Harry Teague and several members of their staff.
Now is the time to move, Taylor-Eyed believes, as corporations develop their own schemes to handle tourists in the Himalayas.
There are big plans to put in pressurized hotels, like a pressurized airplane. You go inside the hotel and it's a different pressure than outside. And they want to put in a jet port in the national park and these large hotels. What are the local people going to get out of tourism if they're a bunch of big hotels? Well, maybe they can be chambermaids or yak drivers, but they're not really going to make any serious money. And we're trying to put together in a partnership between Future Generations and these Aspen organizations. And as a consequence, the local people will be getting the income that otherwise would be going to the larger hotel corporations.
Aspen architect Harry Teague has left his fingerprint on the town, designing everything from affordable housing and schools to small hotels. Teague also designed three of the 10th Mountain Division huts.
They wanted a hut system. They didn't know how to do huts.
In May, Teague assembled a team to explore the idea on site in Tibet. The plateau supporting Everest is higher on the Tibetan side than in Nepal. This alone presents challenges, both to the tourists who will come and to the Americans charged with building the huts.
Actually, they start at about 14.5 and go up to 16.5. They're very high. I mean, the lowest of these huts is higher than the highest mountain in Colorado.
Plans call for 5 huts initially, with the system later expanding to 15 huts. Teague says the Tibetan huts aren't all that different from those here.
They're going to be unheated rooms to sleep in. You're going to roll a sleeping bag out. There won't be sheets, and have some solar heat, etc. There'll be a community gathering space. We imagine there'll be a hut keeper who will provide basic food.
On his journey to Tibet, Teague found a powerful landscape and a simple lifestyle that leaves the natives unprepared to serve a Western clientele. Although summertime is trekking season, at those oxygen-starved elevations, the cold never really loosens its grip.
They don't even have a word for insulation or cozy or, you know, comfortable. Doesn't exist in their language. This is not a concept in Tibet. So that's where we come in. In other words, we bring the sort of a Western standard of comfort.
For now, each hut will accommodate 20 trekkers. A second hut on each site will house an additional 20 porters and locals. They will eventually operate the huts and collect cash directly from the tourists they serve. Taylor-Eyed envisions a system that will one day be able to accommodate the 100,000 annual tourists that the Chinese government predicts will visit the Chomolungma National Nature Preserve.
Mount Everest exists. There is such an enormous pressure on people going to Mount Everest. It's not a question of whether they're going. It's a question of how they're going to be going. And what we're trying to do is to make sure two things happen, that the environment is protected and that the local people benefit.
In Carbondale, I'm Marilyn Gleason for Thin Air. In Montrose, if you hear music on the street, chances are it's country and western. But one day last fall, that changed when Punk-O-Rama came to town. High Country News editor Michelle Nyhaus was there.
Welcome to Montrose, punk rock capital of the Western Slope. Tonight, kids from Telluride, Grand Junction, and Crested Butte have converged on the Montrose Fairgrounds for the Punk-O-Rama. Inside Friendship Hall, underneath wholesome-looking felt banners from 4-H and the Future Farmers of America, the New York band Agnostic Front is playing to a crowd of about 200. The 5 bands of the Punk-O-Rama were invited here by the Montrose Skate Society, a mostly kid-run organization. Part of the $12 ticket price goes toward a new skate park in town. There are a few adult chaperones at the doors, but they look like good sports, wearing Skate Society t-shirts and Dayglo earplugs. The Punk-O-Rama bills itself as the longest-running punk tour in history, and it really doesn't feel that different from the punk shows I went to in high school 10 years ago. There's even a huge sweaty guy in the pit, getting his kicks by pushing people around. Almost everybody seems to be having fun.
And I jumped off and landed on everyone, like 7 times.
I almost fell on the guitarist, but went and crowd surfed for like ages, but then people ripped off my shorts.
I don't know, it's really fun. I've been in the mosh pit, got chopped in the throat by an elbow, but it's fun. People get knocked down, we help them back up, knock them back down.
Jamie and Corey hitchhiked here from Grand Junction. They caught a ride in the back of a Dodge Ram.
I like it. It's awesome. Say what you want to say, wear what you want to wear, act how you want to act.
There are even some full-time fans here. Lindsay from Fort Collins tours with the Punk-O-Rama and sells t-shirts for the band All.
It's really interesting because I'm the only girl and the other merch girl, and then there's like 30 guys. So it's kind of rough. I mean, you don't get to take a shower for like 2 weeks, but other than that, it's all right. You're in a different state, different city every day, so it's pretty cool.
I used to think I was a punk, but I'm a long way from one now. In fact, the most punk rock thing I've done lately is borrow this recording equipment without asking. I don't have to worry about the scene dying out, though. Sarah Vowell, a commentator for This American Life, wrote that punk comes from nowhere. Tonight, it looks like she's right on target. Some of the fiercest punk rockers come from small towns like Montrose, where teenagers have to shout to make themselves heard. Ryan explains the staying power of punk.
I think that the original punk was class music. It came from people who were singing about something that was getting them down, just like blues or country or any of those are class music, so it was punk, and that's what I like about it. I think it was about people trying to get out of their situation and get somewhere better.
Punk sometimes dissolves into just a fashion statement, or even, at its worst, a refuge for bigots. But in its purest form, punk is still a way of expressing rage about the way the world is. It's a way of breaking out of what's expected, a way of claiming new territory. And if that territory is the Montrose Fairgrounds, and if you can only stake it out for one evening a year, then you just dance as hard as you can. I'm Michelle Nyhaus, reporting from Montrose, Colorado.
You're listening to Thin Air. Now with another story about music, here's Connie Gotch, our Four Corners Arts correspondent.
In The Tempest, the last of Shakespeare's plays, Prospero remarks that music tames the savage beast. Experience had taught the bard that truth, for he had incorporated song and dance into many of his works. Directors still include plenty of music in Shakespeare productions, but its employment has an added benefit today. Composer for Shakespeare in Santa Fe, Mary Uten, under a big umbrella poolside at the Hotel Santa Fe, one of the many spots in town where artists go to relax.
We tend to put a lot of music into our projects at Shakespeare in Santa Fe. We do a winter school tour every year, which we put a lot of music into because we find it helps the kids relate to Shakespeare.
A dark-haired woman with a big smile, Mary Uten grew up in the Midwest. She learned to compose at Bennington College in Vermont.
At Bennington College, they look at you and they say, okay, write music. And whatever you write is automatically performed by the faculty. So you automatically find out if you're writing music or not. I was writing music, and they played it, and so that's kind of how I got the bug to write music.
When she finished school, she decided to travel and wandered into Santa Fe. That was over a decade ago.
I had friends who were here, classic story, and I just didn't want to stay back east. And so my friends were here, and they said, hey, come check this out. And I came and I never left.
Mm-hmm. Creating music for Shakespeare or any play offers a composer a special challenge.
Creating music for a play is a huge collaborative process because you can't write the music a year in advance and say, oh, here's the music for the play, you know, go ahead and use it. You have to work with what you've got. You have to work with the actors who are cast in the roles. You have to write the songs so that they can sing them. You've got to find musicians who are willing to sit and learn a lot about Shakespeare in between their music cues. It's not the kind of a gig where you show up and you're playing all night. You're playing a little bit here, and then you're listening to a scene. You're playing a little bit there. And even if you're a trumpeter, you may be asked to bang on a drum. There are endless challenges to this job. It's probably one of the more challenging jobs a composer could have.
She often faces tight deadlines. That sometimes requires her to pull a Johann Sebastian Bach and rework her old themes into new ideas.
Well, I have started stealing from myself, actually, which people say is legal. I've tried very, very hard not to steal from other composers, but recently with the amount of music that I've been called upon to write, I've started kind of looking back at...
For all the work, theater music doesn't often live beyond the run of the play for which it's written.
Usually it vanishes into the sands of time. I guess one of my dreams would be to record some of it sometime, because I sure have written a lot of it, but it's never in the budget to record it, so it stays in my computer.
But a full computer disc's worth it for Mary Uton, especially when she works with Shakespeare.
Shakespeare takes you into so many different musical places. It's a vast universe of possibilities, so that you don't get stuck. That's what I really love about it.
Composer Mary Uton. She works each summer creating music for Shakespeare in Santa Fe. In winter, she leads theater and music projects in schools around New Mexico.
Somebody did record Mary Uton's music in 1995 at St. John's College during a performance of A Comedy of Errors produced by Shakespeare in Santa Fe. Playing baritone sax, David Nielsen, percussion, Paul Persons, trumpets, Warren Ten, and Garth Gilpert. Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is brought to you by the High Country Community Radio Coalition. You might be listening to KRZA in Alamosa and Taos, KAJX in Aspen, KGNU in Boulder, KDNK in Carbondale, or KBUT in Crested Butte and Gunnison.
Or you might be hearing us on KDUR Durango, KAFM Grand Junction, KZNU Moab, KVNF Paonia, KRCL in Salt Lake City, or KOTO Telluride.
Funding for Thin Air comes from your local station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We encourage listeners to tell us what they think.
Email us at thinair@tellurideColorado.net. You can go to kgnu.org to hear previous programs.